Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, climate change. Citizens from around the world take to the streets demanding action. As leaders gather in New York for the UN's climate summit, my guest, Bill McKibben, will be there. He's been working to sound the alarm on this issue for decades as an organizer and as a writer. His latest effort to help us understand not just what we're up against, but what we can do about it is in this week's issue of Time. His piece is called 2050, How Earth Survived. He joined me on Thursday morning. Bill McKibben, thank you so much for joining us.
Diane, what a pleasure to get to be with you.
Thank you. I'd like you to read the first paragraph of your piece to set up the thought experiment that you've done.
Let's imagine for a moment that we've reached the middle of the century. It's 2050, and we have a moment to reflect. The climate fight remains the consuming battle of our age, but its most intense phase may be in our rearview mirror. And so we can look back to see how we might have managed to dramatically change our society and our economy. We had no other choice.
So in this what-if scenario, 2020 was the year we finally decided to act. Tell us what had changed.
What's changed is that we're at the moment when we have to act or there won't be another chance. You remember that I wrote the first book about all this 30 years ago.
I do recall.
In 1989,
yeah.
The End of Nature came out. And we talked then. And at the time, we were offering warnings about what would happen if people didn't take the advice that scientists were giving them. And people didn't take that advice. And so now those warnings have turned into bulletins from the front line every day, some epic fire, flood. We're watching sea level rise. We're seeing ice melt. So far, we've raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree Celsius, and that's done all kinds of damage. But we're on a path at the moment to raise the temperature of the Earth 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, 7, 8 degrees Fahrenheit. If we do that, then we won't be able to have civilizations like the ones we're used to. And the scientists tell us that we're at the pinch point, that if we do not make the fundamental transformations in the next few years, that we'll have no chance of meeting even the modest targets that we set in the Paris Climate Accord some years ago. So 2020, in this telling, becomes a real fulcrum. It becomes the point where we either take action or see some of the chances for that action being effective disappear over the horizon.
And your hope is that 2020 marks that point where there is no longer this belief that man has nothing to do with climate change. So what happens?
First of all, let's don't wait till 2020. Tomorrow, September 20th, 2019, is going to be the biggest day of climate action in the planet's history. The young people like Greta Thunberg that have been school striking for action on climate change have asked adults to join them, and it looks like it will be the largest day of climate action in the planet's history. We expect millions and millions of people engaged in at least 7,000 demonstrations around the world. So the political part is relatively straightforward. I mean, if we're going to do anything about climate change, we obviously have to get rid of the guy in the White House who denies that climate change is real, who believes that it's a, as he put it, a hoax manufactured by the Chinese who pulled America, the country that put more carbon in the atmosphere than any other, out of the Paris Climate Accords. That's the beginning, but it's obviously not the end. Then one would have to go to work. And at this point, going to work, since we've waited 30 years, looks something like the Green New Deal. It looks like really big, comprehensive push for very rapid change.
So in your thought experiment, there is a new president, and the first thing that she does, I emphasize she, is to put the U.S. back into the Paris Agreement. Tell us how important that is.
It's both important and at some other level merely symbolic. The Paris Climate Accord was the furthest that the world community has gone in dealing with climate change. And it set very good official targets, said that we would try everything to hold the rise of the planet's temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius, or 0.5 degree more than we've already done. That's as good as we can do at this point. There's no way to erase what we've already done. The trouble is that the Paris Climate Accords was also a set of pledges from various countries about what they were actually going to do, non-rhetorically. And when you added up all those pledges, if we implemented them all, the temperature of the planet would still go up 3 degrees Celsius, 6, 7 degrees. And of course, many of us, the United States in the lead, are not implementing those promises yet. So Paris is the first thing that this new president does, but then she says Paris is nowhere near enough. We have to go way beyond those commitments. And we can go way beyond them because the engineers have done their job, and the price of a solar panel or a wind turbine is 1/10 what it was a decade ago. That means we're in a position to really, well, to, I guess, make hay while the sun shines, you would say.
So in your scenario, Congress gets rid of the filibuster. Talk about why that's so important.
Because if we're going to get anything done on the scale that needs doing, it's probably not going to be through the slow traditional work of endless compromise. That was the position we were in 30 years ago. 30 years ago, modest steps like a modest price on carbon would have done an enormous amount. You know, they would have steered the ocean liner that is our economy a few degrees off course, a few degrees one direction or the other. And 30 years later, we'd be sailing into a different ocean. But we didn't do that because of the massive campaign of lying, really, led by the oil industry. We didn't do anything. We instead engaged in this completely stupid and sterile debate about whether or not global warming was real. And we went full speed ahead. So now we're at the point, having emitted more carbon since 1990 than in all of human history before, that there are no longer any easy, modest ways out. Now we have to do things on a different scale and a different time frame. And the thought that there are going to be 60 votes in the U.S. Senate anytime soon for doing the things that we need to do seems unlikely to me.
So what are the most important items that that Congress undertakes and passes?
Item one, massive build-out of renewable energy, probably using something like the federal job guarantee that the Green New Deal envisions. This is possible to do now, and it has many salutary side effects. Just for instance, as you know, we're poised on the brink of going to war with Iran on behalf of Saudi Arabia this week, a world that ran on sun wouldn't fight over oil. Second thing that Congress needs to do, pass the various pieces of legislation to keep carbon in the ground. All the Democratic presidential candidates, or I think almost all of them, have now promised an end to drilling and mining on federal land, which is a big deal because that's where much of this carbon's coming from. And several of them have also announced plans to end fracking across the United States, which we badly need to do. A carbon price would probably be a part of this work as well. From there, we need to remember that not every bit of power in our world is political. At the same time we're doing those things in Congress, we need real pressure on our economic institutions to be changing. I have a big piece in the New Yorker website this week talking about the ways that the biggest banks in the world, Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, B of A, the rest, have become the monetary lifeline for the fossil fuel industry. In fact, they've dramatically increased their lending to the fossil fuel industry in the years since the Paris Climate Accords. So we need action right away across a broad front.
In creating this new landscape with solar panels and wind turbines, you're talking about guaranteeing federal jobs. So helping the economy at the same time you're assisting the environment.
One of the interesting things, if you think about it, are the economic knock-on effects that come when you change to renewable energy. Now, it's true that there are people who will be hurt in the transition. I mean, there's people already hurt because we've been automating the coal industry, and so they've lost their jobs. And if we stop burning coal, which physics tells us we need to do, there'll be more people.
Right.
They need that kind of job guarantee to make sure that they can take those skills that they have now and transfer them into other work. But say we're going to go to war with Iran. We know that that would cost us $1 trillion because that's what it cost us to go to war with Iraq or Afghanistan, multiple trillions of dollars. If we spend that money now instead on putting up solar panels and wind turbines, one of the economic benefits of it is that after that, you know, when the sun comes up in the morning or the wind blows in the afternoon, the power arrives for free. You've changed the economic paradigm in a remarkable way, and you're no longer sending a check every month off to the Koch brothers or the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You instead are keeping that money close to home, and it's hard to think of any kind of transition that would do more to kind of stabilize and localize and make more secure the economies that are now leaving us deeply insecure in every possible way.
It's so interesting because the United States is already secure as far as its oil production. In fact, we are exporting oil at this point, and yet continuing to say that Saudi Arabia's production could hurt the entire world in terms of what happened with the strike against their oil fields.
Absolutely, because we're terrified about the price of this commodity going up. One of the good things about the sun is no one's managed to corner the market on it. Now, in one sense, that's what's held us back. Believe you me, if Exxon owned the sun, we'd have developed it a long time ago. But no one does. That's why Exxon's fought so hard to make sure that we didn't develop renewable and deploy renewable technology.
When we come back, more from Bill McKibben.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Bill McKibben. He's founder of the Grassroots Climate Campaign 350.org. His latest book is titled, Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Now, back to your piece. All of this hits Wall Street, which it sounds like you think is a good thing.
I do think at this point that the economic system needs to come to grips with what we're doing. We've built a carbon bubble that's bigger than the housing bubble of 2008. The scientists have told us how much carbon we can burn and have any chance of meeting the necessary targets. But we've got far more coal and gas and oil than that. In fact, we have at the moment about 20 $6 trillion worth of coal and gas and oil that we can't physically burn if we're sane civilization, and yet that's already on the books in terms of what these companies have told their shareholders and banks and things. So it is necessary to figure out how to be writing down that damage. It's funny, our Federal Reserve has done nothing about it, but the Bank of England has been working hard on this for the last 3 or 4 years. Its governor, the equivalent of the Fed chair in England, instead of wasting his time running around scrambling to answer Donald Trump's tweets, has been embarked in a really serious effort to try and get insurance companies and banks and others to cut their exposure to fossil fuel. We've been working very hard on this too. This massive divestment campaign around the world has now become the largest thing of its kind in history. We passed the $11 trillion mark last week in endowments and portfolios that have divested their holdings in fossil fuel. One of the most dramatic announcements came the day before yesterday when the University of California system, the biggest higher educational system in the world, announced that it was divesting its $80 billion endowment and pension fund from fossil fuels. And that was a really remarkable moment along this campaign. It's a sign that the smart money is already beginning to flee fossil fuel, and now we need that fleeing to accelerate.
Well, of course, it's not just the United States involved in all this. In your thought piece, you talk also about India and China. What are they doing?
It's a very good point. In that time story, China and India, of course, play decisive roles because they're growing so fast, their economies. The good news is we can already see this starting to shift. China's now putting in renewable energy at a pace we've never seen around the world. They're doing it in part because of their fears about climate change. They're very vulnerable to sea level rise along the Pearl River Delta. They're exquisitely dependent on the continued operation of the Himalayan ice pack, whose melt provides the water for the Yellow and the Yangtze. But mostly they're doing it because their cities have become unlivable, and they know that no one on Earth needs electric cars and things faster than they do. The only exception to that rule may be India, whose cities are even dirtier. India is where China was 15 years ago in terms of its energy transition, and it's beginning to look as if the rapid falls in the price of solar and wind power may allow India to be the first big country that at least partially avoids going through the coal, fossil fuel phase at its most extreme point, and parts of its economy will move straight to renewable energy, just as they moved straight to cell phones a generation ago.
Take us back to 2050. Say we've done all the things that we need to do that we could do. You say that climate change continues to progress. So what does our planet look like in 2050?
Our planet is hotter and harder to live on than it is now, but it isn't impossible to live on.
You're talking about in 2050 losing a portion of the East Coast. Talk about what you see there.
This is the more difficult part of this scenario in this time story. We're past the point where we're going to get off scot-free. Even if we do everything right at this point, things we've set in motion will take their toll.
You are saying it's already too late.
For certain things, the temperature is going to go up somewhat. And with that's going to come big change.
Right.
I think it's very hard to work out a scenario where southern Florida escapes in anything like the shape we know it now, for instance.
What happens to New York?
Well, New York is very vulnerable because it's low to the sea. Anyone who's ever stood at the Battery, looked out at the Statue of Liberty, knows how close to the sea it is. Lower Manhattan's so valuable that people will spend huge amounts of money to build the seawalls and things to defend it. And we may be able to do that, at least for a while. We may not. One of the best future-looking novels of recent years was Kim Stanley Robinson's remarkable book, New York 2140, in which large parts of Gotham had been submerged. I think that if we act very boldly now, it's possible that we can limit still sea level rise to the point where New York will be New York, but we don't know about that. And in any event, it's going to take lots of money and lots of attention, and it's going to take lots of nimbleness too. We're not going to be able to inhabit places the ways that we used to. We're going to have to be more light-footed, more able to deal with the damage that nature is going to bring more often, and more resilient. Those are going to be the watchwords much more than growth.
Do you see a greater density in city living?
Absolutely. Urban life is by its nature more efficient in a lot of ways than suburban life. And so the move back into the cities is good news. But as we watch it happen, there's a kind of NIMBYism even in cities that prevents them from reaching the kind of density and transportation corridors and things that we badly need. That's a big part of the debate that's underway, say, in California right now around housing prices and the future. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that.
What about cars?
We default immediately to talking about cars when we talk about transportation. Let's say first that the easiest, best, cheapest transportation benefits come from public transportation, come from walking, come from bicycles. To the degree that we're dependent on cars, we need them to be electric, and we need that electricity to be produced renewably. The good news is, as I say, the price of producing that electricity goes down every year. The price of batteries is now falling quickly. The price of EVs, electric vehicles, is falling quickly. Once we have a fleet of electric vehicles in place, one nice bonus, it's like having a giant battery. All those plugged-in cars at night provide an enormous amount of current that we can take back and forth off the system.
Already, we're seeing more forest fires and typhoons and hurricanes. You've got these things happening all over the world, so you see an awful lot of movement, people wanting to move to get to safer places. And it's going to be hard to find those safer places.
You've put your finger on what may be the most difficult of all effects of climate change to deal with. There are going to be many, many people on the move. The UN estimates we could see 1 billion climate refugees this century. Almost universally, those are not the people who caused this problem. The iron law of climate change is the less you did to cause it, the sooner and the harder you get hit. We better come up with something other than cages and walls to deal with this, because they won't deal with it. This is probably the best example of why a new ethic of solidarity is needed, because we face a truly global problem for the first time, and the solution better be global in nature, and it better begin with those places, the United States most particularly, that did the most to cause this problem over time.
What do you hope people will get out of your thought experiment?
I hope that they will get out of it the resolve to go to work right now. If we're going to have a chance at 2050, it depends on 2019 and 2020. We retain a window, a narrow one and a closing one, but if we act quickly and boldly, we can keep the worst of this from happening. And that's an enormously important step to take. It's going to be a very difficult century, no matter what we do. The question is, will it be an impossible one? And the answer to that will come with how quickly we move now. It's good that people are using induction cooktops and LED bulbs, but we're past the point where we can solve this crisis one Prius at a time. We have to come together the kind of notion of endless economic growth based on absolute hyper-individualism can't be the vision of the future. We need a kind of solidarity between human beings that allows us to put a priority on survival, on our joint survival. You and I aren't going to be around to see the end of this story, Diane, but we will be around to see whether we make the necessary beginnings, to see whether over the next few years we take the steps that are required to put us on this journey. We can't win this fight over the next 2 or 3, 4 years, but we can lose it. And that's why it seems so urgent to me that we act now in order that we have some kind of future for those who are around in 2050. Now we need people coming together in the movements that are big enough to allow us to make political and economic change. We have to change the ground rules. We have to change them fast. And that can only be done, or so history would indicate, through kind of big mass action.
To what extent do you see the people in this country ahead of what the laws are already mandating?
Well, look, that's a good question. At the moment, the breakdown politically around climate change is so starkly generational that it's sort of painful, at least for me, being on the older side of the ledger. Look, young people get it. Below the age of 38, this is the biggest issue, most important issue, not just for Democratic young people, but Republican young people. It's the issue that they know matters. Above the age of 65, it's statistically difficult to find people who care about it. One hopes, and maybe these climate strikes tomorrow will be a place where we see this starting to change. One hopes that people's love for their children and grandchildren will be more than rhetorical, that they'll actually start to demonstrate that by demanding change on the issue that will determine just what kind of lives their children and grandchildren get to have. It's really kind of undignified to let 15-year-olds solve all the world's biggest problems by themselves. So the rest of us better join in as best we can.
I want to ask you a little about California and the administration's challenge of California's emissions laws, trying to take California to court. How do you see that playing out?
I see it playing out in court over the next few years, but it's a classic case of what the Trump administration in every way. One, there's no reason to do it. No one that one can find is in favor of it, not even the auto companies. Two, it's done, I think, mostly because it's a way to reverse something that Obama did. And if, you know, in his sort of odd narcissistic world, that's of great importance. Three, it brings us delay and uncertainty at precisely the moment when we need speed and vigor. And I guess that's the point. The climate deniers in the Trump administration just do everything they can to make sure that we're not able to make this transition at the speed that we need.
So, of course, Friday does begin events surrounding the UN Climate Action Summit. What do you realistically believe will be accomplished there?
I would not hold my breath for some piece of, you know, important legislation to come out of the UN General Assembly. The best we can hope for is that some countries will recommit to the promises they made in Paris. The UN has done much of what it can do. At this point, it can shine a light. It can provide exposure for the good and for the bad. It's up to all of us. And so, you know, I think that the UN is only as good as its member nations allow it to be. And at the moment, they're not allowing it to be as good as it needs to be. We have to fight this fight in our various countries. And that's why it's so good. If you go to globalclimatestrike.net, you'll see no matter where you are on this earth, and I mean anywhere from Antarctica to the Arctic, you can find a strike to join. And that's what we got to be doing.
Bill McKibben, so good to talk with you again.
Diana, great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg. and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Irv-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.